This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. Humans have been living in cities for a really long time. But like a lot of things about the past, getting around cities used to be just needlessly difficult because we didn't have reliable maps or street signs or even addresses. An address is something we all take for granted today. But in ancient Rome, if you wanted to go to a friend's house, you had to use all kinds of context clues. Like you had to remember that the house was two blocks away from a big column, but if you reached the horse stables, you'd gone too far. And you had to rely on non-visual cues, like smells and noises.
You had all sorts of noise and, you know, street hawkers, and you had different smells. You had the smell of, you know, a meat market.
Yes, sometimes you had to use meat smells to figure out where you were going.
Maybe one of the ways you navigate is you navigate much more by your senses. You can actually use what you're seeing and what you're smelling and what you're hearing as a ways of navigating around the city.
This is Deirdre Mask.
I'm the author of the address book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power.
Deirdre's book looks at how the world has changed since street addresses became popular during the Enlightenment. So today, we're going to take a tour through some of the many ways street addresses shape our lives, including how we fight disease.
54 Frith Street, London, England, the office of Dr. John Snow.
So street addresses come up in the 1700s, and they made all sorts of new things possible. And one of the first things they revolutionized was our approach to public health. So could you tell me how addresses related to the cholera epidemic in London?
A doctor called John Snow. This is in the Victorian London. He was actually a very prestigious doctor, but he lived actually right next to a slum. And when a case of cholera broke out in London, he was able to track the cholera in the slum. Now, at the time, there was no germ theory of disease, but he had this idea that it was spreading through water. And he was basically able to get death certificates, get people's addresses, do some shoe leather work himself, and trace where everybody was. And then, you know, they sort of were clumping around this pump. John Snow took off the handle of, or not John Snow himself, the government took off the handle of the pump. The cholera epidemic goes away. He was able to use these location and disease to find the source of the cholera. But speaking to modern epidemiologists, I learned that actually what John Snow did in 2 days in Victorian London is actually impossible in huge swaths of the world today.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that countries without good address systems have a much harder time fighting disease. And you bring up Haiti as an example. Tell me what happened there.
You know, there was a terrible earthquake, as we all know, in Haiti in 2010, which was followed by a vicious case of cholera that spread throughout the country. And when I spoke to logisticians at Doctors Without Borders who were coordinating the response to the epidemic, basically they weren't able to track down their patients in the same way that John Snow could track down the patients in this London slum, which, you know, severely hindered their ability to stop the spread of the disease. So, you know, it's a complicated story, but basically, if you don't have a way of finally tracking where people are, you don't have a way of finally tracking where disease is.
Addresses have a lot of positive effects, like tracing disease, and they make it possible for the government to provide services and things like that. But they also give the state a lot of power, and that power can be abused. So could you talk about, you know, the tyranny of addresses, so to speak?
Yes, in the book, I talk about the example of Austria during the Habsburg Empire, during the reign of Maria Theresa, who had an issue, a problem, which is that she, you know, was fighting all these wars and she needed good, strong men to fight in the wars, but she was having trouble finding them. So she ended up sending out the military to number the houses in her kingdom, and while doing so, taking a kind of census. And people did not like these house numbers. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it, especially if you've never had a number before, because numbering is, as there's a scholar named Anton Tantner who's written about this extensively, it's dehumanizing, you know, nobody likes to think of themselves as a number. But also it has this function of, if you were able to live your life in relative privacy and then suddenly you're revealed to the state by a number painted on your wall, there is something deeply upsetting in this. So this was a good thing in a sense to get numbered, because often this ushered in positive changes like, you know, taxes and getting around, and people love the post. But there are downsides to this as well, because now the state can find you, it can imprison you. There are all sorts of negative aspects to being found, as anyone who's ever received junk mail or solicitations can know in a milder form. the story of what happened in Austria and also across Europe as house numbers came up is a story basically of the conflicting views we have about the state being able to find us and identify us.
I'd never really considered the sinister side of addresses until like a little while ago, actually. I had a friend of mine who was a journalist and a long time in Cambodia. The government was, you know, trying to impose addresses in parts of Cambodia who, you know, within living memory had genocide and a purge of people. And the citizenry there was like, that. Like, I do not want the government to have any knowledge of where I am. And it kind of blew my mind because I thought of addresses. I mean, I really didn't think of them at all. I thought of them as neutral things. Did you notice in your research that depending on how benevolently you viewed the government and viewed type of control, how people took to the concept of addresses versus people who didn't have that experience?
It sounds very familiar to me. And so the way I got started on this whole project, the first thing I wrote about was about West Virginia, about a very rural county in West Virginia called McDowell County, which at the time had no street addresses. The state embarked on a huge project to give them street addresses. And so I went and I interviewed, you know, lots and lots of people. In some ways, it was started out sort of like a quirky story because, you know, people would fight over naming their street Crunchy Granola Road or, you know, there was a street, one official told me, where, you know, a certain kind of older lady lived on that was called Cougar Lane. You know, it was just, at first it was quite quirky. But then you started hearing stories about people who really didn't want addresses. And you talked to the addressing coordinators and they actually found their work really difficult. And there were reports of people coming out and meeting addressers with, you know, machetes in their back pockets. And people often would say, oh, those are just, you know, they would see them as being ignorant or backwards or, you know. But you know what? The more I read about addresses, the more I realized that they knew what a lot of other people didn't know, that these addresses weren't just designed as they were being pitched to provide emergency services, even though that's extremely important. I'm not denying that that's not an excellent reason to give addresses. But they knew there were other benefits to the government of being able to finally track its citizens. This was seen as a violent act, actually exposing them to the eye of the state. So I guess a lot of it comes down to how much you trust your government as well. And obviously, in the example you gave, if you're a dissident or you're someone who the government's not going to like for whatever reason, you're probably not going to like addresses either.
Today, it's believed that over a billion people in the world do not have an address. That includes people without a home and residents of small towns and encampments. And not having an address creates a lot of problems.
No fixed address.
So you make a case that having an address is actually an equity issue. Not about just having a home, but like having an address. So what does an address give you access to?
Well, this really comes up when I was researching homelessness, because then in my head, I was like, who are the people who don't have addresses? And obviously, it's people without homes. And one thing I found from talking to experts on homelessness, but also activists, was that when people without homes are asked, what do you need? Well, by definition, they need a home. But what a lot of them said was they needed an address. And so there were stories, you know, of people saying that basically what they needed was a way of pretending that they weren't homeless. When you apply for jobs, it lists address, even though there's no way, you know, you're going to get mail to this address or employer's going to show up at your door. But they said they needed an address, even if they were just called.
Yeah. And when you're homeless, it's hard enough to get a job, but you can't even apply for a job in many cases. Like when they have these mandatory address lines on an application form.
You know, the World Bank has seen addresses as one of the cheapest ways of lifting people out of poverty, because if you give people addresses, they have a way of pretending that they aren't homeless and a way of accessing all kinds of services. So to go back to your question, there's all sorts of things you can't do. You'll struggle to get a bank account. You'll struggle to vote. You know, where I live in England, there's a National Health Service. Almost all communication is done through letters. And when I was researching this, I was calling up GP practices to find out how you register, you know, while being homeless. And even though I am a person with a home, I found it incredibly difficult to get out to even pretend for my, you know, investigating into homelessness. Mm-hmm. I found that incredibly difficult.
Is there a way to level the playing field for people without addresses?
Yeah. So one of the proposals that's been made is something called Ban the Address, which, you know, has been modeled on this Ban the Box movement in the US. And by the box, it means not allowing employers to ask about your criminal history, you know, basically stopping people from discriminating at first glance against someone. And there's something similar at Ban the Address. There's no reason that employers need your address, at least at those early stages of the interview process. There's also a very clever way that's come up with in England by a man named Chris Hildry, where he's basically teaming up with Royal Mail to use the addresses of empty homes, so that if you could just be assigned the address of an empty home and you could use this, and the mail does not go to the house, you know, even if the home gets moved into, it doesn't matter. It's the same way as if you move, your mail gets forwarded for months and the people currently living there will have no idea this is happening. And so people can get the letters that they need, but they can also use it as a shield showing to people that they have an address, which sometimes becomes a proxy for, you know, a productive member of society.
A street address can indicate that someone's been fortunate in life. Many streets like Park Avenue in New York have become associated with luxury and prestige, while others have developed reputations as bad neighborhoods, reputations that are sometimes totally unfair.
1 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, Atlanta, Georgia.
There are hundreds of Martin Luther King streets in America. They're often in neighborhoods that are less well off. Why is that? What is the cycle that has created the sort of the idea and the stigma of Martin Luther King?
I think the estimate now is 900 streets named after Martin Luther King Jr. In America today. And they're often, interestingly enough, in the American South, right next to the names of Confederate generals. And commemorating a street after Martin Luther King, who was, you know, obviously the most prominent icon of the civil rights movement, largely, it was Black communities that named streets after Martin Luther King as a way of commemorating him. Sometimes they were put in neighborhoods and, you know, to inspire the residents. I put inspire in quotes. But in some of these situations, these were neighborhoods that weren't particularly nice, to put a point on it, because of the forces of racism mm-hmm. and poverty. And this meant that the name, for some people, was entrenched with this idea of poverty and crime. And it's why Chris Rock, you know, in his stand-up had a routine in which I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, if you find yourself on Martin Luther King Jr. Street, run.
It ain't the safest place to be. You can't call nobody and tell them you lost on MLK. I'm lost. I'm on Martin Luther King. Run! 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 The media's there!
Everybody laughed. I admit, you know, I'm Black myself. I laughed as well. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not funny at all. And sometimes you can track MLK streets and find out about Black America, but also you can find out about the perception of Black America as well. Because one thing I found in my research was that, you know, there are researchers, for example, who have found that if you compare the economic fortunes of streets named after Martin Luther King with streets named after JFK or even with just main streets, you know, MLK streets aren't that much economically worse off. You know, they're different. They have more churches, for example, or they have more, you know, more schools because these are white collar jobs that were open to Black people. But they weren't any worse. And one of the conclusions that I come to when I write about this is that, you know, yes, a lot of these streets have suffered, but also perhaps we think of MLK Jr. streets as dangerous streets because they're Black streets, and we're always going to associate Black streets with being dangerous and poor and neglected. And thinking about that is another way of thinking about race in America today.
Today, more and more streets around the world are named after famous people from history. And this is why street names have become a proxy for so many arguments about who we are and what we stand for.
The British Embassy at Ferdowsi Avenue and Bobby Sands Street, Tehran.
One of the stories that really fascinated me in the book was about the Bobby Sands Street in Tehran. And there's this incredible tense history between the UK and Iran, and making a Bobby Sands Street seems like a real provocation. How did it end up that there is a Bobby Sands Street in Tehran?
Yeah, it's interesting. There is a Bobby Sands Street in Tehran, which is right by the British Embassy. And for anybody who doesn't know, Bobby Sands was a hunger striker in Northern Ireland, a member of the Irish Republican Army. And so it was an unusual name to have in Tehran, especially by the British Embassy, because the British really were Bobby Sands' enemies. Yeah, no, I'd heard the story about these teenage boys who had changed it. So I tracked one of them down, who told me this amazing story that, you know, after the revolution, there were a lot of young people who were very politically involved, including himself, who'd gotten involved in politics at a very young age. And they're fairly wealthy residents of Tehran. So they're in quite a fancy neighborhood near the British Embassy. And they had this idea that they were going to change the names. Sounds to me a bit like, you know, Stranger Things. They're all on their bikes going to
the hardware store and they buy this glue that they have to powder and mix water in, and they're basically able to mimic signs, and they change the signs to read Bobby Sands Street. And this would have been shortly after Bobby Sands died, after his hunger strike. The city later ratified it, and there's Bobby Sands Street. And weirdly enough, for a hunger striker, there's a Bobby Sands burger bar.
Oh my God.
Also in Tehran. And the reason I found this fascinating was that it's just a light on commemoration, you know. Why does this matter? And in fact, we know it does matter because the British Embassy actually ended up opening up a new entrance so that they didn't have to be on Bobby Sands Street, which I believe used to be Winston Churchill Street, mm-hmm. You know, so they could have a new address because obviously they cared. So yeah. It sort of opens this window of what commemoration means and why we care so much, really.
Yeah. They were angry at the British Empire. And they knew that that Bobby Sands would be a finger in their eye, basically, you know, just like it just would poke them.
Yeah. So there's Bobby Sands Street in Tehran, but there's Bobby Sands Streets all over the world. You know, I think I counted 5 in France, for example.
Wow.
But the interesting thing I found was that there aren't any actually in Ireland. So this is actually sort of a fascinating idea that you have this fighter who, for a lot of people, depending on your belief system, would have been a martyr and a great man. And yet you have all these names named after him elsewhere, but you don't have any in Ireland. And basically the explanation I came to is that Ireland doesn't have any consensus on Bobby Sands. Up close, his legacy is a lot more complicated than it was for those teenage boys in Iran. This whole idea of commemorating is really trying to figure out what we're about. And what Ireland has said by not giving up Bobby Sands Street is that at this point, at least, that's not what they're about. You know, Bobby Sands' Ireland is not today's Ireland. And that's really, for me, why there is no street name after Bobby Sands in Ireland, yeah, or north or south.
2211 Freedom Street, Hollywood, Florida.
So right now, there are lots of arguments about street names, especially in the U.S., where they're named after Confederate generals and historical figures like Christopher Columbus. And you spent months covering street names in Hollywood, Florida, in particular. So what was happening in Hollywood, Florida when you were there?
Yeah, well, in Hollywood, Florida, there were parts of the city that were historically Black. Part of the city called Liberia had 3 street names that were named after Confederate generals. And the worst of them of all, in the eyes of campaigners, was Nathan Bedford Forrest Street. People knew who Nathan Bedford Forrest was. He was not only a major figure in the Confederate War, but he was also seen as one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. And so you have these street names, not only, you know, in this part of Hollywood, Florida, that was really intended for Black people when Black people weren't allowed to live in integrated areas. And so there was an activist, a man who actually just recently passed away, I'm sad to say, named Benjamin Israel. He's a really interesting man. He was from New York. He's African-American, but also Orthodox Jewish. And he basically, just for months, just appeared at every city council meeting. And I watched many of these things, where he would be talking about these street names while everybody else was talking about Airbnb regulations. And finally, it really started to click. And eventually, they did overturn them. And it really, in a lot of ways, exposed a lot of racism, but also a lot of other feelings about street names in the battle. And for me, one of the most interesting things was, you know, I'm African-American. In the book in general, I try to stay fairly neutral about these things, but I'm not really neutral in this. I thought that street names should change. Yeah. But it was interesting hearing the other side. You know, I listened to, you know, many speeches about this, that there were people who would say things like, I live on Lee Street, named after Robert E. Lee, and I don't care anything about Robert E. Lee, but, you know, I met my husband on Lee Street, my babies were born on Lee Street, I want it to be Lee Street. In my head, I connect it to that, which makes a lot of sense, because in our brain, we do tend to connect place and memory. So it makes sense to me. I'm not actually promoting Lee, I just like the name Lee. And I think that now the conversation has changed, and it's like, we can't just, you know, rest on this nostalgia argument, even if you say you're not actually racist. And I actually believe this. I don't actually think this, you know, for a lot of these people, this was a show of racism. But it's just this idea now that I think people are having this thing, well, we just have to change them. You have to take action to change them, which I think was often missing. But in Hollywood, Florida, they did change the street names.
Yeah. And so what did you think of the solution of Hollywood, Florida? Like, they didn't replace, like, Robert E. Lee Street with, like, civil rights icons. They replaced them with, like, Freedom Street and Hope Street. So what do you think of that outcome?
This became a debate as well over the course of the talk, because people wanted to name it after an activist, for example, who helped integrate beaches in Florida and the like. And, you know, there was even a suggestion at some point by one council member to just number the streets, which is obviously an American solution. And then nobody wanted that either. And then I would think about it. I was like, well, why is that? Just thinking about it from an objective standpoint, why is that such a bad solution to number streets? And the reason is that street names have become like monuments. a way where we preserve our memories. And there have been a lot of historians, Pierre Nora comes to mind, who talk about history moving incredibly quickly. Mm-hmm. This idea of the acceleration of history, that things just change so fast that we really have to start salting away and packing away our memories into things so that we don't forget when things start to change again. And I think that's why suggestions like numbering don't fly, because it's not just that people don't want Robert E. Lee's name down. They want to make a statement and they want their street names to make a statement. So it's not simply about the taking down, it's the putting up as well. And so Hope, Liberty, and Freedom ended up being something that united people in some sense. But yes, the bolder move would have been to actually name it after an activist who actually, you know, fought against the principles that the Confederate generals were aiming for.
Yeah. And you think that solution is okay, like that compromise of freedom, hope, and liberty?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's not really for me to say whether it's okay or not. But at the same time, I mean, people often decry these arguments are terrible. I mean, I like these arguments. I mean, as I say in the book, you know, arguments divide communities, but they make communities as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if we didn't have these arguments, they simply numbered it, if they simply changed it. I think actually there's a lot to be gained from people talking and listening. And even now, I know people don't often listen, but, you know, there's engagement there. There's an exposure there. You know, we're trying to decide what these things mean for our society. And for Hollywood, they decided that hope, liberty, and freedom would be great. I mean, obviously, you know, in a lot of ways, I think it would have been even better had they pushed it further from my own personal perspective. Yeah. But, you know, I do like that there's this process through street names often that, you know, exposes what people believe and what they believe their community is about. And I think that's valuable.
As more of our life becomes digital, are our physical addresses becoming obsolete? More with Deirdre Mask after this.
Soak Heavy Pounds, Oakland, California.
We don't really need addresses anymore. You mentioned this, that there are ways to get a driver's license or pay your taxes. You can do a lot of stuff online. Could you imagine a world without addresses in the future?
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely could. And I mean, you kind of even imagine in some developing countries that they're going to bypass addresses altogether for something more digital. Yeah. And there are lots of companies that are really getting the act. Google's gotten the act. They've got a, you know, great sort of digital system. There's this company I described called What3Words, which is given addresses in just three basically random words that they've mapped the whole world. So I can in some ways imagine it.
Could you describe What3Words and how it serves as an alternative to physical addresses?
Basically, this company has divided up the world. I believe it's 3 meters by 3 meter squares, but I could be wrong about that, but very small chunks. And they basically given every single one of these squares a 3-word address.
But it's not a street name like we think of. They've given it 3 words. So I clicked on a random spot not too far from where I live that's, you know, create door statue. You know, 3 entirely random words. And point of this is that you can isolate things much quicker, you know, just 3 meters by 3 meters. And also you can find things that generally don't have addresses, like the middle of a park. You know, if you're on a hike and you want to map out where you took a picture, you can use the What3Words address. But they've also been used in places that don't have addresses. So they've been used, for example, in Mongolia, where there isn't the traditional street addressing system that we're familiar with, say, in, you know, the US.
Mm-hmm. And you can remember it because you can remember 3 words pretty easily, as opposed to like some map coordinates, which are very like long and abstract string of numbers. But what is the limitations of something like What3Words?
Well, I mean, one of the limitations, I think, of all of this is that I spoke earlier about how, you know, the state was in control of addresses. But in a lot of ways, we tend to trust states more than we trust companies. I mean, let's see if that's true anymore. But but in general, we do this idea. So you have a company like What3Words, which I think has come up with this sort of brilliant invention, but they are a private company. This What3Words technology is bound up in patents. Using it, you can't use them as freely as you could use your addresses.
Right.
It does mean that you're sort of beholden to a private company to find out where you are in a lot of ways. Right. And that something about that makes me really uncomfortable. Also, it takes away the meaning. You know, we talked a lot about these commemorative street names and, you know, how street names have meaning for better or for worse. you know, addresses are sort of the way we navigate the world and we connect ourselves to other people. So one problem with a lot of these digital addresses is that you become a string of numbers or, in the What Three Words case, a string of words that don't connect us to our neighbors or don't connect us to our communities. So I think it has many uses, especially for places that don't have traditional addresses or for these other uses, but I still would like to hold firm to our traditional addresses.
"99% Invisible" was produced this week by Chris Berube. Music by Sean Riau. Our senior producer is Delaney Hall. Kurt Kohlstedt is the digital director. The rest of the team includes Emmett Fitzgerald, Joe Rosenberg, Vivian Lay, Abby Madon, Christopher Johnson, Katie Mingle, Sophia Klatsker, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of 91.7 KALW in San Francisco and produced on Radio Row, which is scattered across the North American continent, but will always be centered in beautiful downtown Oakland, California. We are a founding member of Radiotopia from PRX, a fiercely independent collective of the most innovative, listener-supported, 100% artist-owned and operated podcast in the world. Find them all at radiotopia.fm. You can tweet at me at Roman Mars and the show at 99pi.org. We're on Instagram and Reddit too. We have lots of new merch in the 99pi store, including Amabier masks and t-shirts with funiculars on them. Plus, we have links to purchase the 99% Invisible City. It's the new book. It's out October 6th. It's all at 99pi.org.
Radiotopia. From PRX.